welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, regular host for the show and founder of Yes to Life, the UK's integrative cancer care charity. So the Yes to Life show, like charity, is all about integrative medicine, the judicious combining of conventional oncology treatments with a whole raft of complementary and lifestyle therapies with the aim of improving quality of life and outcomes. One of the features of integrative medicine is that, as a movement, it's been primarily patient-driven. And this is now starting to spill over into the arena of research as well. Andrew Scarborough is someone with an extraordinary tale to tell of his own encounter with advanced brain cancer, but also of his journey of discovery, finding out firstly how to manage his own situation, but then spreading his net wider into the world of cancer science. Delighted to welcome you to the Yes to Life show.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate everything that Yes to Life does, and I'm happy to share anything about my story.
That's great. So I've been a lot too slow getting you on the show, as yours is a long and outstanding story. It's made, and I think it continues to make, substantial waves in the field of cancer. So why don't we go right back? I'd like to start out by asking you to tell us a bit about what your life looked like and what your plans were before you were diagnosed with cancer.
Well, before I was diagnosed with cancer, I was working as a personal trainer, and I was heavily involved in getting more into sport and exercise and sport and exercise sciences because that was my background. So I had a sciences background, but it was more into sport and exercise endeavors.
Right.
And then around that time, I thought I was extremely fit and healthy, health conscious, very interested in nutrition. I was on a pescatarian diet at the time. I thought this was like the best diet ever, but I was feeling more and more fatigued and suffering from migraine attacks all throughout 2012. And so that kind of rang alarm bells in my head from the symptoms that were coming from my head. I couldn't make sense of it because I was trying to figure out what was wrong and taking time out of work, thinking I was maybe working too hard. And the headaches were just getting worse and worse. So I saw my GP, and I saw my GP a few times at this time, just trying to work out what was going on. Never any thoughts that it could be something serious. So I was just sent away with medication to manage the headaches. And I decided to quit my job because it got so bad. And I decided to use that time to study a master's in nutritional therapy, partly to try and work out if I could help myself and what was going on. A while through the course, I learned some interesting information about, first, it was the paleo diet that was quite a big thing at the time, 2012.
Oh, yeah.
And then I learned about ketogenic diets and how they could be used for, it's the first time I knew they could be used for epilepsy, in drug-resistant epilepsy in children. But at that time, I hadn't ever heard that, and until at that point, that you could also potentially use these diets to help manage cancer.
So you found that out before you knew you had cancer then?
Yeah, I had a lecture on it.
Amazing.
And it was seen as a very controversial lecture, which is quite funny. There was a big Daily Mail article about what the university was doing with not just that, but Chinese medicine and complementary therapies. There was a huge, it became a huge thing that the university was doing. This is the University of Westminster.
Yeah.
And so, Yeah, I actually dismissed it at the time. I thought, no, this is ridiculous. It's a diet that just has lots of... At the time, I thought this diet just has loads of bacon and eggs and things, you know. It's not that kind of healthy.
Yes, that was seen as the antithesis of the healthy diet in those days, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was very high fat and lots of things like eggs, which, you know, high in cholesterol. And at that time, I was on a pescatarian diet, so it's very plant-based and fish twice a week, oily fish twice a week. And if I did have things like eggs, it would mostly be egg whites. I wouldn't really have the yolks. And I have lots of just olive oil is my, olive oil's good, but yeah, it just has just lots of olive oil with everything. And so I couldn't find any solution to my issues, and they were getting worse and worse as I was going further into the course. And I just decided to try and ignore it and hope in the hope that it would get better. But over time, it got to the stage where it was impeding on my ability to exercise. I was very, very active, just naturally, and very competitive with my running times. And I was doing biathlons at the time. Duathlons. It's a different thing because I didn't like triathlons. So it was running and cycling, and very competitive with it, and very competitive with sports as well. So, yeah, after a run in central London, I went on the train to go back home, and I just remember it was a really busy train, and I felt like I had the worst flu ever. My head felt like a medicine ball. And as I sat down on the train, I managed to get a seat somehow because it was absolutely packed. This pain in my head just became more and more intense to the point where I knew that something horrible was about to happen. And I felt like that was going to be it. I felt like I was going to die on that train. And then all I remember is I lost control of all my kind of movements and my speech. So I was making strange yelping noises uncontrollably. And I felt a huge, kind of like an explosion in my head. It felt like someone hitting me over the side of the head as hard as they could with the hammer.
Right.
And then I just went unconscious and woke up on the other side of the train on the floor, very confused with muffled sounds of someone above me. And then I slipped out of consciousness again and ended up in hospital with suspected diagnoses of an arteriovenous malformation, which is an entanglement of abnormal arteries in the brain.
Right.
And that can be fatal. So I was told I recall just a whole host of medical professionals surrounding me, looking very interested, but very concerned. And just going in and out of consciousness and having grand mal seizures.
Right.
But every time just before I'd go into one, I'd have an aura and I'd feel like I wasn't going to wake up. So,
right.
Just very confused and every time waking up with quite severe injuries, dislocated limbs, broken bones, bruises. So yeah, at that point, didn't know what was going on. Had lots of different diagnoses thrown at me.
Right.
It kept changing because I did have a CT scan after entering the hospital, and it was so vascular that they couldn't really determine what was there. And so the plan was to wait until things cleared up a bit and then have an MRI scan to try and determine what they were looking at. And after the MRI, still wasn't very clear. So the diagnosis then was that it's likely to be a cavernous hemangioma, which is a cluster of abnormal blood vessels. And to cut a long story short, eventually my seizures were so severe and life-threatening that I had an emergency operation, and I was on the maximum dose of anti-epileptic drugs I could be on, as well as a lot of painkillers. So I was really spaced out, not really quite knowing what was going on. And I had rehab in the hospital because I lost my speech and my right-sided movement was compromised. So I eventually got home when I could walk a few steps. And I was told, this was coming up to the weekend, I was told on a Friday evening that they'd made a mistake. And the histopathology report showed that I had been, the neurosurgeon told me on the phone it was a terminal brain cancer that was treatable but not curable. And I didn't really know what that meant.
Right. Set you up for the weekend.
Yeah. And I was told, I've booked an appointment for you to discuss chemotherapy and radiotherapy on Tuesday. And him admitting he made a mistake, and also telling me that alongside that he had to leave some residual disease on the motor cortex area, on the motor strip area in my brain because of that misdiagnosis. Otherwise, I may have had an awake craniotomy rather than an asleep one.
Right.
And so that I was just, in shock. Couldn't say anything.
Devastating stuff.
Yeah.
So tell me, how long was the period from when you first started getting your symptoms to the time of the crisis?
Well, I had symptoms all throughout 2012, and they were getting worse and worse.
Right.
And at this point, after the surgery, while there was still disease left, and there was significant brain damage from the brain hemorrhage that I'd had that revealed the underlying brain tumor.
So what was the actual diagnosis? What kind of cancer was it?
So the final diagnosis then was an anaplastic astrocytoma brain tumor.
Mm-hmm.
That had, it was IDH1 wild type, which is supposed to be the bad one.
Right.
And it was unmethylated MGMT. MGMT is a DNA repair protein. And if it's unmethylated, then it's indicative of being unresponsive to treatment and carrying a very poor prognosis.
Right.
So it wasn't looking good.
And it wasn't looking good at all. So, okay, so you went in on Tuesday and to discuss the treatment they were proposing, which wasn't going to cure you but might do something for you. What were you offered and what did you think of it?
So I was offered the standard 6.5 weeks of chemo and radiation and cycles of chemotherapy after that for 6 months, and then seeing how that goes, and then having another 6 months. And because I was the bad type, unresponsive type, the idea is to give you treatment anyway because there's no other option.
Right.
And not only that, but to do it indefinitely. So to have the cycles of chemotherapy that keep going on.
Right.
And just seeing how that goes.
So not a great offer there.
No, but at the time, I just accepted it, and I was thinking, I was accepting the diagnosis and that I was going to die.
Right.
And actually now the classification system has been updated. So that type of anaplastic astrocytoma that I had could have potentially been a grade up from that. So grade 4. Because they now characterize these subgroups of tumors differently, such that an IDH1 wild type and unmethylated MGMT anaplastic astrocytoma brain tumor could potentially be classified as a GBM because it behaves more aggressively.
Right.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, aunt and deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
You know, you said he wasn't going to be able to cure you. What was the prognosis? How long did he think you were going to live?
Well, he was hesitant to say, but I got it out of him because I like to know these things.
Okay.
People don't always like to know, but he said likely 2 to 5 years. It's quite a range, but
it's quite a range, and but quite generous too, all considering.
Yeah,
yeah.
There was concern because the disease that was left was on the motor cortex area,
right,
where my parietal lobe was, and it covering the initial tumor was covering 3 different lobes. And so I had 3 different types of epilepsy as well as the grand mal seizures that I was suffering from. And they were pretty relentless despite being on all that medication. But I had done some reading and I purposely put myself on sodium valproate, which is known as Epilim, the brand name Epilim. I did some reading about how that could potentially make the treatment more effective, could sensitize mm-hmm. the tumor to the chemotherapy and the radiotherapy. And also I realized that it had some kind of effect on the gut microbiome and that gut brain connection, because sodium valproate is it's valproic acid, which is a short chain fatty acid. And these short-chain fatty acids are active and they have an effect. And so it's having that bidirectional effect on the gut and the brain.
Hmm.
And so I thought this is worth trying. You know,
okay.
it's an anti-seizure drug. At the time I was mostly, I thought it's not going to harm me and potentially it's going to help with my epilepsy. And that was my main concern at the time, because I was just having these seizures constantly. And
no kind of life.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the event, how long did you have treatment for?
So I had treatment for a few weeks, and then I decided to give up on the treatment when it was making my seizures worse. And I'd realized that my tumor would not be sensitive to it regarding what I'd learned about the histopathology. And I was learning all the time at this juncture, so I wasn't as educated as I was going to be. And at this time as well, I was transitioning onto a very strict ketogenic diet to manage the epilepsy. And I was still thinking that it had no real validity for brain cancer because all we had was preclinical studies. And through when I learned about it at university, I learned that the idea was to starve the tumor of glucose. But then I learned about the work of Harry Eagle and how he found that glutamine was also a major fuel, and I thought that's not going to really be a solution. And so I was mainly focused on the epilepsy, and I didn't think it had any validity.
Interesting. So two major kind of incidents in your life there, one being lectured to about the ketogenic diet and then actually starting it for another reason. Fascinating.
Yeah. And this was 2012, so we didn't really... beginning of 2013 at this point.
Right.
And we didn't really know... We don't have in anywhere near as much as the information that we have now.
No, I remember, yeah.
And I'd read through that lecture, actually, I'd read Tom Seyfried's book, Cancer as a Metabolic Disease.
Fresh off the press at that time.
And yeah, it had only just come out the year before. So I found this absolutely fascinating and I decided to contact him, thinking he's not going to respond. And he did. And it was a very thorough point-by-point reply to all of my questions that I had, because I had many questions at the time. And I was still highly skeptical. And so I thought, well, I'll just give this a try and see how it goes. I actually was initially on a 4-to-1 ketogenic diet because I knew that's what the children with drug-resistant epilepsy have. That's what they go on, and it works for them. But it actually failed spectacularly when I started. And I was thinking... Why are my seizures actually getting worse? And then I read that as you transition, your seizures can get worse before they get better.
Oh, right. I'm glad you found that out before you gave up.
Yeah. So I was patient with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had some side effects of having migraines. And I thought, well, I can't continue if I'm having these migraine attacks, which are just as bad as the seizures. And so through my research and through going on more of an elimination-style ketogenic diet, I realized that there was a thing in the literature called an oligoantigenic ketogenic diet.
Okay, never heard of that.
And so what that is, well, oligoantigenic diets are, it's a well-known kind of exclusion diet for epilepsy, which doesn't necessarily have to be ketogenic, but it's where you have certain foods that can trigger an allergic-like response where seizures are provoked. And so you eliminate those offending foods and then that magically stops the seizures.
Gotcha.
Regardless of if it's ketogenic or not. So I found this really interesting because I'd noted through keeping a food and seizure diary that there were certain foods that were traditionally ketogenic that were triggering my seizures. And so I cut out dairy and I cut out even avocados and coconut oil because I noticed that those were strangely provoking my seizures. And I cut out just most foods apart from apart from eggs and organ meats and yeah, just mainly eggs and organ meats, actually. And then
pretty hardcore diet, eh?
And fish, oily fish. I had lots of seafood, actually. I based it mainly on seafood. And I found that those seizures completely stopped.
How long did that take?
Just a few weeks.
Right.
Yeah.
Amazing. You must have been very pleased with yourself.
Yeah, and at this time I was figuring a lot of things out. So I was monitoring my blood glucose and blood ketones routinely, and I discovered that there was this therapeutic zone that I could stay in that would give me optimal seizure control. And so I made it my mission to try and stay in this zone. And I'd also noted that when I'd slip out of that zone, say if I was wasn't necessarily food related, if I was stressed, if I had poor sleep, then that would cause me to have a what's called a breakthrough seizure, where it's just you have a trigger and suddenly you have a seizure out of the blue. And so I realized at that point as well that my type of epilepsy was a type of epilepsy called reflex epilepsy, meaning that my seizures at this point were not spontaneous. I could identify known triggers that would cause these seizures, and if I stayed away from those triggers and if I stayed in this therapeutic zone on my glucometer, that I could not have any seizures and feel almost completely normal.
Maybe.
I say almost, because I still had a significant amount of brain damage.
Right. That's it's a level of self-observation that few people will be up for. Obviously, it was a big prize in your case if you could actually get it right and it worked. So I presume that gave you the motivation.
And over time, interestingly, I was still having my MRI scans, and I'd noticed that the signaling activity that was shown on the scans was actually dissipating. And these scans can be fairly ambiguous, so you can only really speculate, but that could either be a sign of brain damage, or even migraineous activity can show up as enhancement on some scans.
Right.
Signs of epilepsy, epileptic activity. And so as a kind of test to see what was going on, I had a type of scan called MR spectroscopy. And very few places in the UK have that ability to have this machinery, but this type of MRI. What that does is it shows you various peaks and troughs that are representing the bioenergetics of the tumor area. And you can identify what type of tumor it is based on that, as well as look at how what substrates it's using for energy. So,
so it's a lot of information.
Yeah, it allowed me to understand that my tumor was highly glycolytic. And so that actually gave me more of a feeling that this approach and the intermittent fasting and all the other things I was doing, taking boswellic acids as well, all these things that I was doing was potentially having an effect. Now, I will say that I was taking the boswellic acids in the form of Boswellia serrata and frankincense, and also a frankincense resin. I was doing that because I'd read that these compounds inhibit an enzyme that's involved in the arachidonic acid pathway. So inflammation, essentially, and that you could inhibit that process somewhat to combat that neuroinflammation that was causing my seizures and could potentially also reduced the brain swelling that I had initially and could potentially treat the cancer.
Mm. And famously, one of the properties of the Boswellia tire is its ability to get to the brain, which a lot of things don't, of course.
Yeah, I was taking high doses of the Boswellia serrata and
right.
And the other boswellic acids in different forms, and very high dose magnesium as well.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
The station that makes you feel good.
Gauging that level of inflammation, were you relying on these scans or did you have another way of doing that?
Somewhat fortunate for me is that my type of epilepsy was extremely sensitive to any kind of change. So that became my barometer.
Right.
And the area that my residual disease was left in, I was told if that shows any growth, you'll know about it. So it's not really, I was thinking it's not really even necessary to have scans because I wouldn't, if it grows back in the same area, I would know about it because I would either, depending on which direction it grows in, it would either kill me because I would have a seizure and I would die, or I'd have some type of paralysis, or I would just experience more seizures, so I would know about it. And so I was having scans and they eventually improved, and at one point I had hyperbaric oxygen therapy because I had significant scar tissue in that area and significant fatigue.
So the scar tissue is from the damage from the actual when you had the initial fit on the train, or is it from the surgery?
It was a lot of things. It was the brain hemorrhage that I'd had that revealed the tumor, and then every seizure that I had caused further damage,
right?
Because they were quite violent, and then the surgery.
Right. Okay. And yeah, hyperbaric oxygen is a great one for healing in that way, isn't it?
Yeah. And at that same time, I was taking exogenous ketones and ketone esters.
Do you want to just explain what those are for people?
So we produce ketones endogenously from the liver, but there are exogenous, meaning outside the body, sources that you can take kind of like a supplement. So it bypasses that needing to make your own ketones. You can take it as beta hydroxybutyrate, which is the therapeutic ketone body that gets to the brain, and has been shown therapeutically in rodent studies to have some kind of effect. And at this point, I knew that the effects of a ketogenic diet and ketone bodies had different mechanisms of action. It wasn't just about starving the tumor of glucose and glutamine. it was about managing that neuroinflammation and also having these ketone bodies acting as signaling, like kind of like signaling molecules. So they would have effects on several signaling pathways involved in angiogenesis and hypoxia and all of these other areas. And so
that information came from where? Your own observations, some kind, or from your reading?
At this point, I was just reading constantly, so I was learning.
Yeah,
just everything that was new on PubMed and.
Right.
And I'd learned so many different things just from thinking outside the box as well about my symptoms and what that could mean. With the hyperbaric oxygen therapy, I was actually having seizures when I started. And so that's an example of how to overcome that, I did research into what I could do to improve my seizure threshold in the chamber, because the people operating the center didn't want me to continue because it wasn't
scary
safe.
Scary for them. Yeah.
I convinced them that I'd learned of this technique that was used by the US Marines, whereby to withstand deeper pressures in the chamber, allowing the oxygen to get to the tissues, they would increase the seizure threshold by kind of like with exercise, improving their resistance to the oxygen by taking off the mask. I was in a chamber with other people, so I was able to do that. So doing breathing exercises without the mask and then having sets of sets and repetitions of breathing, like you do with exercise. You exercise a muscle and it gets stronger. In this case, it's allowing the alveoli to adjust to increasing amounts of, not necessarily amounts of oxygen, but it's allowing that uptake under these deeper pressures more efficiently. It's becoming a more efficient process. Yeah, it's an air brake. It's called an air brake technique, and I learned about it just from my research.
Yeah, high pressure workout.
Yeah, it worked incredibly well. And I was able to withstand very deep pressures, and I was able to continue for just over 6 weeks every day doing this.
Well, that's a solid block. So the center learned a thing or two as well out of that.
Yeah. I was a bit mad initially, but I was a bit
You persuaded them.
Yeah.
Well, good on you. Very good. Okay, so where are we? Give me a date where we are now in the story.
So that would have been 2015.
Oh, okay. So about 3 years in.
Yeah, and at this point I was coming off my medication, starting to come off my medication, which I was told would be impossible and a reckless thing to do.
Right.
Which would have been correct, but I was my quality of life was really poor. I'm the kind of person that suffers all of the rare side effects that are in the booklets. And so without any help and with lots of reading, I learned about withdrawal seizures and how to manage those effectively so that I could come off of my medication completely. And I managed to do that in 2 years. So 2017, I came completely off those.
Really off. Okay. And have you taken any medication since then?
I took melatonin, which I still take now, and I take it in cycles. So I do it for a few weeks and then I come off, because I just feel like that's a good way to do it.
A good plan. Yeah. No, it works with a lot of things, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing. So your health now, just describe your state of health now, what you can and can't do.
Well, I still have some brain damage, which will likely never improve completely, because that's the nature of the brain. It heals very slowly. But I'm able to manage that very effectively by sticking to a very strict diet. Interestingly, my tolerance to foods that used to trigger seizures has almost completely resolved. So I'm able to have a very different kind of ketogenic diet now to what I was doing previously. It doesn't have to be a 4-to-1 ketogenic diet anymore. And yeah, I still have great sensitivity to dairy, so I have to limit that. But when I do, I tend to have goat or sheep, high-fat goat or sheep dairy, because I know that it's supposedly less inflammatory. And it's a raw diet, so I'm very conscious of the gut microbiome and potentially how being on sodium valproate and taking the exogenous ketones may have changed my gut bacteria, because I realized that beta hydroxybutyrate has effects on the gut, which I still feel underappreciated. And I still do a lot of fasting. Fasting's always been a big thing for me. But when I fast, I'm very mindful of my electrolytes, because I tried doing a long fast when I was beginning doing this, and it triggered seizures because I was depleting myself of electrolytes, and when you do that, you're more prone to having seizures. So I found that I could then in future go on these longer fasts, but having my own electrolyte drink that I would make up that had sodium, potassium, sodium bicarb, magnesium sulfate, and I would just drink that. If I was feeling like I was hungry, or if I was feeling like I was tired, or like I was having a lower seizure threshold. And interestingly, with the hunger, having that electrolyte drink really just completely obliterated that. Because that was my main issue when I started fasting. Just
really,
I found it really difficult because I would just get hungry. And now I barely get hungry at all.
Interesting. So an enormous amount of self-observation gone on, even to find out that you could go back on things. You had to try it out, presumably. And
yeah,
one at a time. All these things. It's a very painstaking stuff, this. But I think that characterizes your whole journey. You've done an incredible observation job here, which has actually meant you've learned a fantastic amount about yourself. But that's also, some of it can be generalized to other people as well. So it's really useful information.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So look, but before we run out of time, I want to talk about another strand of your life that incorporates the kind of trailblazer side of your character here, research. So you've got the attention of the community of people involved in the arena of brain tumours. That's both patients and professionals. And you've got involved in some hugely interesting research initiatives. So do you want to tell us about those?
Yeah, well, after my diagnosis, I decided to enter the field of cancer research. So I studied cancer biology, and then I did various postgraduate courses at Imperial College and other institutions, and I got to the point where in 2015 I wanted to do a ketogenic diet study with the Brain Tumor Research Organizations. I won't name them, but and I was encountering great frustration since then, because I had lots of promises that never amounted to anything. And so this year, last year, I decided to do my own research and do it myself, and have it not just be a ketogenic diet study, but have it be a brain tumor metabolism study, looking at, I'm not allowed to say too much about it, but
okay,
establishing a metabolic phenotype of glioblastoma, by working with, we're working with a brain tumor support charity called Brains Trust, who are enrolling patients for us who are newly diagnosed glioblastoma patients. And they come into the lab, have various tests done. And then what we do is, this is before they've had any treatment. And so we're able to see, I won't say what we're looking at, but we're able to see what's going on metabolically. And we're able to, from looking at the cohort of patients, establish certain patterns and see how we can target the metabolic dysregulation that we see. And so I'm doing that at the University of Westminster with a great friend of mine who's doing her PhD. I decided not to do a PhD. That was the route I was going to go down, but I thought it would be too much stress for me and I didn't want stress. So I get the best of both worlds. I still get to do the research and I get to, I get to do the research and I don't have to do a PhD.
So, I mean, one of the obstacles to research is well known, of course, is the money. Mm-hmm. How have you managed to fund this?
Well, it's a self-funded study, so that helps. It also helps that I'm working with someone who has been a donor to the university, because, yeah, you always need someone with lots of money. And I have some donors that will remain anonymous. They want to remain anonymous, who are very interested in helping us. So that's been hugely beneficial. Right. But we always need more money. So
sure.
If anyone
anyway, wants... this is the metabolic community ganging together basically to make this happen.
Yeah, but we always need more money. So there is, I do have a page that people can donate to if they
go on and tell them about it. Yeah, in case anybody's listening.
And it's on beatbraincancer.co.uk. So if you look at there, if you look there, you can see what the study involves and why we're doing it, and donate if you can. Yeah,
great. Well, I love this stuff. This is what I'm now terming patient-centered research. It's my new term for this, which is, patients going out to find out what they want to find out. And I mean, we've had the whole thing with patient-centered care, where we had the old model where basically people were delivered the treatment they were told they were going to get, and their job was just to be passive recipients. And there's been a move for about 30 or 40 years to just move that over a little bit so the patient's got something to do with it. It's not succeeding very well yet, but hopefully we will get there one day, where the patient will be at the centre of care, which does happen, of course, in integrative medicine. But anyway, patient-centred research, I think the same kind of thing applies, basically. There's a huge wealth of research going on, but most of the answers are not that interesting to people who've got cancer. So, but there's some great answers coming out of people who have cancer or have got cancer, who are doing it for themselves. And, the advent of the internet has been extraordinary for allowing people to inform each other directly without anybody getting in between, and for the people like you to access all this information for yourself, to work out your own situation and to learn from it. And to me, the rate of learning that's going on amongst people like you is much greater than is happening in all the rest of cancer research, because they're looking for answers that are really meaningful. Mm-hmm.
The other thing that will be revealed from this research, well, that's the hope at least, is that oncologists will be able to hopefully look at markers in the blood that they can then say, okay, this is a marker of disease progression, or this could be, we can work with this to come up with a protocol that can support this patient, that we understand what it means, and we have data to show that we can target this. It's something that we can think about therapeutically. And as you say, we have so many of these patient anecdotes so many of these N of ones, these case studies. We need to bring all these people together and we need to try and have some research like this so that we can then show to clinicians to make some meaningful impact. So it's not just people's stories like mine, you know. That's why I wanted to get into the research.
Absolutely right. It's great. It's really good. But I think, you know, your case in itself, because you've been so thorough in what you've done, you've actually produced a lot of information from it, which is, okay, it probably hasn't made a massive impression out there in the world of cancer research, but through the mechanism of direct communication, a vast number of people have been inspired to learn, oh, I don't necessarily have to die from this type of cancer. There's somebody over there who's still alive and they're looking good. That's amazing. You know, we didn't have that in the past. All these things happened in isolation and the rest of the world never heard about it. So it's a great thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I hope you see yourself as a bit of a revolutionary. I mean, you know, it's a big change that for going from an ugly death, very predictably, to the prospect of possibly living well is night and day, and a huge message of hope.
Over 10 years now.
I know, it's amazing, it's fantastic. And yeah, I've been fascinated by your progress all the while, because of course I was aware of you right at the beginning when you were first turning up at events and things, so that was pretty early on to 2012. All right, so we're just about out of time. Quick final question. Looking back, what, if anything, would you have done differently knowing what you know now?
Sounds a bit controversial, but I don't think I would have had any of the treatment. And I'm not saying I'm against the treatment, because possibly being on the sodium valproate helped to maybe sensitize the tumor to the treatment that I had. but I guess we'll never know.
That's it. Some things you just don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right, interesting. Okay, well, look, a big thank you for coming on. Brilliant story. Really great to hear it. And good and very best with your research.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Have a good day.
Cheers, then. What a great story. You can have nothing but admiration for someone who forges such an independent path against the odds and who's now turning his hand to helping others. And if you want to check out his research project, the address again is beatbraincancer.co.uk. Thanks very much for listening today. I look forward to bringing you another expert guest in next week's Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.